May it please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing defendant Vicki Reed. Defendant is raising on appeal several arguments related to the economic damage award in this case, specifically the damages related to past and future medical expenses. First, the trial court permitted plaintiff to recover future medical expenses when she did not disclose them under Rule 26A. She only disclosed past medical expenses in the amount of $47,000. On the first day of trial, the court sustained defendant's objection, reasoning that introduction of this evidence of future medical expenses would prejudice defendant because it had not been properly disclosed. But at the conclusion of trial, defendant objected to instruction number 12 because it permitted the jury to award future medical expenses. And despite its previous ruling, the trial court overruled defendant's objection. The court allowed plaintiff to request $8,000 in closing argument based on a proposed trial management order that plaintiff filed 30 days prior to trial, but which was not signed either by the court or by defendant's counsel. And plaintiff did not disclose any medical expenses, $8,000 or otherwise, under Rule 26A1C, which was why the trial court initially precluded plaintiff from recovering them in the first instance.
Is there, I could not find in the record a copy of the proposed trial management order. Is that?
I remember seeing it. I thought it was in the record. I'm pretty sure it was on the disk that I received, and or ISIS.
We'll double check. But let's assume for the moment if that's not there, then we don't have. Aren't we required to assume the document would have supported the trial court's ruling?
The trial court ruled that defendant's counsel was aware that in this untimely filed trial management order, unsigned trial management order, plaintiff listed $8,000 on it. I can see that did happen. So to the extent I'm conceding the regularity of that proceeding, yes.
Okay.
But because, even assuming that occurred, of the non-disclosure, the trial court erred in instructing the jury in accordance with instruction number 12 because it permitted plaintiff to recover future medical expenses as the jury deemed appropriate, and the jury awarded $125,000 in economic damages, so it necessarily awarded damages for future medical expenses.
And in fact, didn't the defendant state in closing argument that the jury could award, they said, when you get back to that jury room, you can do anything you want, you can give her everything she's asking for, if you think it's appropriate? That was the argument made by defendant.
I do not recall defendants making that argument to the jury. I know that the plaintiff's counsel asked for $8,000, but I do not recall defendant's counsel telling the jury they could award anything they want. I'm certain that I didn't intend to impart to the jury that they could award future medical expenses that were not inappropriately submitted to the jury.
So you don't consider that to be a waiver of the objection to?
I don't.
Okay.
Plaintiff argued that he only requested $8,000 in closing argument per the court's instructions, but the jury was informed by the evidence in the jury instructions, not plaintiff's closing argument, and the jury in fact awarded more than $8,000 in future medical expenses necessarily.
Defendant, I realize defendant objected to that jury instruction, but it did not the request that the instruction had been lost on that. It did not, defendant did not request the jury instruction be limited to $8,000, did the defendant?
Are you asking, did defendant ask if the jury instruction should be modified and limited to $8,000? No.
And nor did they suggest a limitation, something on the verdict form that would indicate that?
No. Defendant objected to that portion of jury instruction number 12, which permitted the jury to award future medical expenses in its discretion. Next, the trial court permitted plaintiff's treating chiropractor, Chad Cotter, to testify, even though plaintiff did not list him as an expert. Plaintiff only listed Dr. Pamela Knight as an expert, and although the case management order in this case stated that treating healthcare providers would be considered experts under Rule 26B2, that rule requires the party to provide a summary containing the qualifications of the witness and a description of his or her opinions and the basis for them. Plaintiff did not comply with this requirement. Dr. Cotter testified that the same chiropractic treatment he provided plaintiff in the past could be helpful to her in the future. Therefore, defendant was necessarily prejudiced by this testimony because it could have served for the basis as the basis for the jury's award of future medical expenses.
There was additional testimony presented on that by Dr. Knight, the plaintiff and her mother, that was unobjected to. So doesn't that render Dr. Cotter's testimony, or does that render Dr. Cotter's testimony cumulative of admitted testimony?
Well, Dr. Knight's testimony was properly admitted because plaintiff did comply. But to answer your question, I don't think that's true, because the jury can believe all, some, or none of any witness's testimony, and the jury might not have believed Dr. Knight and might have believed Dr. Cotter instead. We can't know that, because under rule of evidence, whatever the rule of evidence that precludes inquiring into the jury's thought process, we just don't know. But my answer is no, it doesn't render it harmless error, because another witness testifies similarly. Finally, plaintiff's exhibit 18 reflected $79,000 in past medical expenses, approximately $79,000 in past medical expenses, not $47,000 as reflected in the trial management order and plaintiff's disclosures. The trial court initially sustained defendant's objection to exhibit 18, subject to further discussions by counsel, which of course aren't part of the record, but notwithstanding the court's ruling sustaining defendant's objection, exhibit 18 was admitted into evidence, and we submit defendant was necessarily prejudiced by exhibit 18, since it was an amount that exceeded the disclosed amount of $47,000 in past medical expenses.
My reading of the record was that the judge said when the issue came up, the plaintiff's counsel said there were some inaccurate things or something on the document, and said we'll talk to the defendant's counsel, and the judge said, "Will you two talk, and I won't admit it until you've spoken." Then I think maybe it was Ms. Padilla testified. And after 30 or 40 pages, the document was offered in evidence. An objection was made by the defense that there wasn't an adequate foundation, but there was no request for a ruling on the prior objection, no reiteration of the objection. So it went into evidence. And I think several hours later, inadvertently, or I didn't want to track things, plaintiff's counsel again asked to move the admission of the exhibit, and there was no objection. So hasn't that been waived?
I don't believe that you have to object to the same exhibit twice in order to preserve the issue.
But there was no, you're saying there was a definitive ruling and defense had no obligation to say, "Judge, you already ruled on that," and we object on the same grounds. They could just, counsel could just sit back and let it go in without saying a word.
Well, I've never seen that issue arise. But I would argue that if an appropriate objection is made to an exhibit, it need not be made twice.
Well, if the court indicates that its ruling is not final, is there an obligation on the party to re-raise the objection later under Rule 103? Rules of Evidence 103, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I do not recall that the exhibit was discussed again after the first time that defense counsel objected to it.
I don't know if it was or not either, but it was moved. The first time he objected was before, it was at the beginning of the trial day, and the court said, "Well, I'm not going to do anything until you two have spoken." Whether or not the two lawyers have spoken, is not reflected in the record. But it was then offered into evidence an hour later through the testimony of one of the witnesses, and the only objection raised was lack of foundation. The court overruled the objection, lack of foundation. Isn't the court entitled to think, well, I guess that issue that was of concern is no longer a concern since the objection wasn't raised again?
Without further discussion, I would argue that no. Once the objection was lodged, it was lodged.
Okay.
It wasn't retracted. So defendant requests a new trial on economic damages, or alternatively, defendant requests the court to remand with directions to remit the award of $125,000 in economic damages to $55,000, which reflects the disclosed amount of $47,000. Plus the $8,000 in future medical bills the trial court allowed, although not properly disclosed, we'll concede that it was on the trial management order that was filed but not signed by either the court or defendant's counsel, but the court in its discretion stated that defendant was aware of it because it was on that subsequent trial management order. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 23 seconds. Counsel?
Yes, thank you. Excuse me, but I appear to have a cold. My doctor said it's not contagious, and I can take my mask off. But I did just get out of bed from 5 days of heck over a red throat. And it gives me pleasure to appear on behalf of Wendy Padilla. We had a difficult trial, and perhaps most of it was my fault.
Excuse me, Mr. O'Donnell, I presume?
Yes.
Okay. You just need to enter your appearance, sir.
Thank you. Declan O'Donnell, number 4412, appearing on behalf of Wendy Padilla. My intent is to save most of my time for further rebuttal after I hear from counsel again.
You won't have an opportunity to do that.
I'm going to watch for it, Kenny. And I appreciate that.
He will not have an opportunity for it.
What?
The appellant has an opportunity for rebuttal, but the appellee does not have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Well, then I'll just march forward.
Yes.
I forgot that.
Don't save any time.
I don't come here that often. You probably recognize that. The issue at hand that I'm confronted with is having been under 37C, orders by the trial judge, almost throughout the entire trial. It started at a point during Wendy Padilla's direct examination at page 75 and 76. And this had to do with the amended trial management order, which counsel for the defense said it doesn't have my signature. And I was ordered that 37C was being invoked and that I would have to follow the judge's orders from then on. And then he ended up, the trial ended up on page 76 at line 24, saying that, yes, but what was in that management, that amended trial management order, was a reference to future medicals and expenses. And so you were, it's really a matter of notice. And so he went ahead and allowed it in. And I said to myself,
allowed what in?
He allowed in the evidence. It's really a matter of notice. Okay. So I think that carried through to allowing me to argue about some future medicals, which, by the way, that amended notice had $8,000 in it, and it was supposed to be $8,000 per year, but I've had a change of staff has become sort of apparent from what was going on, and some of my work didn't come out the way I usually do, and it evaded me.
Why couldn't the other side rely on the $8,000 figure without raising it again? Why couldn't they rely on, well, the judgment will be remitted down to that amount?
You know, I don't know that. Can I tell you the way I do feel about it? Even though I can't, I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know what legal grounds there would be for that. I don't know of any. But the way I feel about it was I made an error, and I told the judge, in closing argument, he instructed me, do not ask for any more than $8,000. And I didn't. And I put an affidavit in there to that effect. And there were other things I got sanctioned on, and you know, I obeyed every single sanction. And I didn't think it was a big, big case. I thought that my client wasn't all that hurt until I heard my doctor finally, through particularly on cross-examination, describe how devastating this was. And that it really was a permanent injury, lifelong, 29 years for this lady. And I was surprised to find out I had such a case. I know that I met with all the doctors before they testified, and I've done this for 49 years, and I thought I knew my case, but I'm surprised. It was a good case for my client. And the attorney should have done a better job.
Do you think the other side might have been surprised as well?
I don't know. You know, here's the other problem that just bugs me, is the lawyer, if you read cross-examination, the way he's going through it all the time, as though he's the doctor, you know. I'm wondering what's going on here. But it turns out that these defendants refuse to employ any medical doctor for any purpose, not even to interview my client. Nothing. They had no medical background of their own. They didn't even stand up and say, oh, I wish I had. You know, it was just something that bugged me because I put a lot of time in on this case, and I thought they were treating it too cavalierly. Anyway. And so I was advised at page 85, line 9 to 12, and this was during the middle of my first witness's testimony. And so this is a sanction under Rule 37, as well as your failure to follow Rule 16 and 26. And I heard that all through the trial, as you remember, so often I get chimed in about that. And so I am in a position here, having been sanctioned, having followed all the sanctions, having done everything that trial judge told me to do. And, you know, if he said it's $8,000, I said, that's it. I'm going to ask for $8,000. And I think counsel admitted that, and I appreciate that. But it was on every single problem. I did the same thing.
Counsel, your client was awarded $125,000 in economic damages, right?
Yes.
What were the components of that? Do you know?
Well, let me say this about that. Last night I took a fresh look at that in the record, and I noticed that during this first part of Wendy Padilla's testimony, we put in 17 exhibits, and I stopped at 18 because that was a big problem, and I concentrated on 18, and I'll get to that as soon as I can. But at that point, we had already put into evidence, and the first three that we put in were small numbers that are all objected to and quickly dismissed by the judge. He didn't even ask me if I had a response. He just said, overruled. And so there were no more objections all the way up to 17. I didn't write down how much money was involved there, but it was an awful lot. It was the surgery, the surgeon's bills in his office, and I think it came to around $80,000. That's what I think. And so that's the best answer I can give you. The rest of it was not necessarily medical bills, there were a lot of other things. But on medical
bills. What other things?
Pardon?
What other things? I mean, the sanction was you couldn't recover for lost wages, right?
Yes.
So there were none of those.
No, I did not mention lost wages ever.
So the difference is attributable to future medical expenses?
I don't know that because the jury verdict doesn't say that. I made a copy of it just to remind me to mention it. And the case law. But here's the, if I may, would you care to receive this? What it is affidavit of myself regarding how I handled that.
Is that in the record?
Yes. It's
in the record. We have that. Thank you.
You think you what?
We have that.
Okay. And then the chart of medical bills and copays, which was exhibit 18. And let me take a quick peek here. You might be right. It might be all medical.
I believe that reflects medical expenses.
Yes, I think you're right. I'll take that back. I stand corrected on that, obviously. All the way down to Joel Carmichael, one of the doctors, and Chad Cotter, and Eric Chanrich, and Dr. Scott Stanley. Anyway, the Parker Dennis Hospital, all of those are in there. And it comes to $79,561. Okay. And they are complaining that that was $47,000 I should have been sticking to, but they had this exhibit for a while. And I guess what the judge started off with was saying that they were on notice.
Well, let me ask you, when they raised the objection the first time, court, as I understand it, said, well, you folks continue to talk.
Yeah.
The jury won't see this exhibit, and the court is not going to admit it until you have further discussion.
Yeah.
Why couldn't the other side believe that, okay, it's not coming in, I don't need another objection, it would be your responsibility to show something had occurred before it could come in? Why couldn't the other side believe that? Remember, I
trust they did believe that. I think they did believe it. I don't think they should have, but that's what happened. I mean, he just said that. That's what they believed. And they did it, never withdrew it, so that he thinks it was still there. I don't think so. Matter of fact, I was having a hard time finding exactly what they did object to. All through this, it was pretty, kind of not always on target. And in that case, it was definitely not on target. And these things come in almost totally without objection. If you read the record the way I read it, that's the way I read it. But anyway, the idea here...
Counsel, what was the justification, was there any justification for not including the medical expenses that are above $47,000 in your original trial management order?
No, I just had a new staff, and I thought it was taken care of, and it wasn't. It was my error, I would think, not correcting that.
Were any of those incurred after the original trial management order?
I don't know. I doubt it. Although I can't say that. I must say that it did very well, because my client was going to Dr. Knight's office all the time. And a lot of it did come in later. You're absolutely, I hadn't even thought of that, but quite a bit did. Matter of fact, this Dr. Knight, obviously, was a good witness, but it was because she testifies quite a bit. And she spends a lot of time with the patients before showing up in court. And I think that is a good component here, Judge. I hadn't really even thought much about it. Well, I remember early on in Wendy's direct, the judge reserved judgment on admissibility of Exhibit 3, which was a 30-day journal that she had written 30 days after her accident, and they objected to it. And I think he admitted that eventually, even though it was riddled with all the complaints they were complaining about. So, you know, it's just one of these things that leaves one to wonder what this judge was thinking. And I think that was, since I had provided them a copy of it well in advance, they had notice of it. I think this trial judge is, if they had notice, I'm not going to sit around and listen to these objections to this extent. Anyway, I think that's what happened. And then, in talking about Exhibit 18, the part of Wendy's testimony that gives me something I should mention, she stated she had an emotional scar. I couldn't fix it at all. That was the quote. And I'm thinking that she certainly did. She went through an awful lot of tragedy here.
Wouldn't that be a non-economic damage item?
Yes, it might be.
And I don't think those are in dispute on the appeal.
I see. Okay. But nonetheless, it just shows that maybe the jury could have latched on to something like that. I never know. Now, if you subtract from Exhibit 18 all the exhibits that, before any objection was made to Exhibit 18, all of them came to about $80,000 of medical expenses had already been admitted.
Your time is up. Counsel, I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
And thank you for allowing me to go on to the time that I should have known I had.
Mr. Epstein?
Thank you. I have nothing further, which puts me 2 minutes to the side of the red light.
Well, thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and a decision will be forthcoming in due course.